This is the Real Estate Investing for Freedom podcast, where we bring on the experts to teach you the golden nuggets of real estate investing so you can escape the rat race and start living life on your terms. Now, here's your host, Dalen Hazel.
Hey everyone, just thought I'd start off this episode with a big thank you for making our first episode a success last week. We got over 60 downloads and lots of kind words, so thank you again for your support. It means the world to myself and our guests that you're enjoying the content. So without further ado, here is episode 2 of the Real Estate Investing for Freedom podcast. Today I sit down with my very special guest, Tom Staub, to teach you the more passive strategies of real estate investing. The truth is, not everybody wants to actively invest in real estate or have the time for it, and that's okay. Tom breaks down a couple of the strategies that he is using, including lending his money out and also turnkey rentals to earn consistent income, even though he is not physically present at the property. But before our interview with Tom, I want to introduce a new portion of the podcast, the Golden Nugget of the Day. This section of the show is all about one actionable piece of advice that you can implement in your business today. Today's golden nugget is to take advantage of the digital tools around you. And I want to preface, these apps are not sponsoring the show. I just want you to know about them since I've used them myself and you might get some value out of it. Personally, I use TurboTenant for property management. This saves me loads of time and I never have to worry about rent collection or paperwork. Also, Slack is my communication tool of choice. It allows me to instantly chat with team members and colleagues across the world. I can even make calls, send files, and much more. So with that out of the way, I want to introduce our guest, Tom Staub. Tom is a serial entrepreneur, business advisor, and founder of the Real Estate Investing Academy. His journey has taken him from the master's degree in finance to Wall Street as a banker for Morgan Stanley, all the way to the tech startup world of Silicon Valley, and finally, over the past 7 years, the arena of entrepreneurship and venture capital. Today, he dedicates his time to sharing with you the knowledge and steps he has used to build a seven-figure net worth and the type of income to live life with complete freedom. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. I'm so glad to have you on. Again, you're just a perfect fit for the show. I was reading your bio, and I'm super excited to dive into the topics that we've set before us. So other than what was shared so far, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got started specifically in real estate?
Yeah, sure. I'll give a 2-minute spiel, but you know, I think I've always been a hungry person in terms of, you know, success. And I grew up pretty poor, right? And that instilled in me this desire to be wealthy. Very young age, right? 14, 15 years old, when I started my landscape business, if you will, doing, you know, flyer to flyer, door to door, cutting grass. That was kind of the genesis of that determination, right? And at age 16, 17, I became interested in investing strategies and everything else. And so I've really always been a someone that has pushed towards the idea of how best to gain wealth, how best to become wealthy. And then when all through college, of course, I was determined to be a banker in Wall Street, did that, hated it. So that lasted about a year. And then I went into the corporate finance world consulting because to me at that time, climbing the ladder to an executive was the way to wealth. I didn't know the alternative ways to build passive income or to build wealth. And then kind of just by fortune, I was living in the Bay Area of California. I was 25 at the time, trying to buy a house, couldn't afford it. Every time I had saved money, the price appreciation outpaced me. So I was like, well, screw this. I'm not going to have cash in the bank. I'm going to use that cash. And so I started buying rental properties in Indianapolis, and it became very addicting. And so I started buying in Alabama, then Ohio, then Texas. And then just naturally with real estate, it's kind of a journey, right? I started in turnkeys. I started doing flips. I then started buying buildings, doing commercial deals. And then I started doing land development and more of the passive lending, which is what I focus in today is more of the, you know, lending and land development, because that is where I see the biggest opportunity right now.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. So the main topic of our show is going to be how you're earning your income in passive ways right now, specifically private lending, because I think there's a lot of folks out there who want to take advantage of lending from the other end, right? The person borrowing the funds so they can fund their real estate investments. So can you kind of dive into that specifically? I know we also want to touch on remote investing, how you're building your empire from afar because you were in Silicon Valley. But can you dive into the various types of lending that you're doing right now? Is it private? Is it hard money? I mean, what does that look like?
Yeah. So, well, one, I live in Austin, Texas today, and I'm loving it here. Have been here for some time, but yeah, you know, I once saw this Gary V skit, and he was making fun of the idea of passive income, right? Because to him, there's no such thing as passive income. And to some extent, I would agree. And there's definitely different levels of passive, right? I think owning a property, for example, is a little more hands-on than most expect. But I do think the most passive form of investing that I have found is what you're referring to, hard money lending or private money lending, right? And conceptually, the best way to think about it is you are a bank and you're giving out mortgages at arguably very high interest rates, 10, 11, 12%. And these are verified borrowers that need money fast. So they borrow these funds because they can get them in 5 to 10 days. And in a market like today, where there's so much competition to get the best deals, you can't wait 30 to 45 days to get money from a bank, right? So they have to go in these, you know, non-traditional routes. And there are people mostly in California and New York that I work with that have a lot of capital sitting in their bank. So these people say, hey, I have, you know, $250,000 in my bank. I have $40,000 in my bank. I don't know what to do with it. Stock market seems risky. I can't find a good rental property. What do I do with it? Well, they can lend it to these flippers at 11, 12% interest rate. And by the way, it's backed by the property. So if they default, you get the property, right? And you're only lending up to 60, 70% of the value of the property. So even if you took over the property, you could work with contractors and flip it yourself and make a profit. So it's a really good investment vehicle. If you're trying to, one, create passive income and two, diversify outside of the stock market or crypto or whatever you're in.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a different world. So your clients are nationwide. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah, predominantly, I'd say 3 out of 4 out of California, mostly Bay Area or LA. I got a few out of New York, and then a couple here in Texas.
Okay. From the investor's point of view, do you recommend going towards a nationwide lender or maybe sticking more grassroots and local for their lending needs?
No, that's a great question. You know, I have a lot of conversations weekly with new clients, prospective clients, and I tell them what matters most in all of these deals. And really, most of your business negotiations in life that I have found are two variables. The first one, kind of the same as the second one, is the team, right? How experienced is the team? Do they have a track record of success? Are they organized? How do they execute? How do they measure against downside risk? So the high level is the team. The team is by far the most important variable in the equation. So if you find a great team in Ohio and you're out of California, that's probably then better than finding a bad team out of California, right? Mm-hmm. So we work primarily with two teams. They're out of Columbus, Ohio, and Kansas City. And collectively, we're doing about 120 deals a year. We're doing 100, give or take, with our Kansas City team, and about 20 in our team in Columbus, Ohio. The second variable that is arguably kind of connected to the first one is transparency. And what I mean is you need to have a trust and a transparent relationship where these lenders are willing to tell you their game plan, willing to tell you their margins, willing to tell you the weak points in their process or the strong points, right? So every quarter, what we do with our team in Kansas City and Columbus, Ohio, we get them on the phone for all of our clients. We have an hour-long meeting. We talk about the portfolio process. We talk about their success, their hurdles, what they're seeing in the market. And that sort of transparency allows investors to, you know, feel more comfortable about doing these deals. What I would recommend against, to your question, is to simply go and just lend your money to a team you've never met, to a team you don't know. You know, you see a lot of these funds now with Fundrise and whatnot. You have no idea who's managing the ground operations, right? So to me, that's a very risky vehicle, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's definitely something that sets your team apart, is that you are fully transparent with your clients. So can you delve into the normal costs associated with borrowing money? Because I know you want to be transparent. So what does that conversation look like with your clients, that 1 hour conversation?
Yeah. So it's from the borrower side. Let me take one step back. So the deal size that these people are doing, they're not your flips for, you know, primary homeowners, right? These properties are properties that are focused for turnkey buyers. And we focus there because we think that option and that type of asset has a variety of ways to exit. And what I mean is a turnkey borrower will first want to sell it as a turnkey, naturally. But second, if they can't, they can list it on the primary market on the MLS and sell it to a home buyer, right? If you have a, if you have the other way around where you're giving money for a big flip for $500,000, you're going to eliminate all of the investors because they won't cash flow as a property, right? So one, we only borrow on or lend on deals that are turnkey properties. And I say that because the deal size is much smaller. So most of our deals are between $40,000 to $80,000 in capital given to the borrower, right? Now, from that standpoint, the borrower cost tend to be between $3,000 to $5,000 on each deal. So they're giving these lenders or these clients about $5,000, give or take, per deal in passive income, usually over a 6 month period.
Yeah, from the investor point of view, to borrow 70 to 80 and only pay 3 to 5,
yeah,
that's a pretty good trade off if you don't have a lot of funds to start out with. And from the passive investor's point of view, that's a great return for 6 months, I would think, for it to be that safe.
That's right. It's between 15 to 18% when you annualize the return. So it's arguably one of the highest returns that I've seen in the market today.
So I'm sure your team does this for the investors, but how should somebody wanting to get into borrowing funds for real estate investment, how should they structure their deals to protect themselves and also protect their investment?
Yeah, good question. So again, from the borrower side or the people giving the money?
The borrower side.
Okay, the borrower side. So if you are a real estate person and you're trying to do a turnkey flip, right? I actually have a risk score that we include in every deal for our clients. But you know, the risk score for our clients is arguably the risk score for our borrowers. And there's four or five main areas that if I were a borrower, I would care about, right? One is margin. I think as a flipper, if you're not making at least $20,000 in a flip for a turnkey, it's not worth doing. Inherently, as you do flips, you tear down a wall, there's going to be something behind it that you didn't expect, right? And that's the same for any real estate development project. So 20,000 is the baseline. Two, obviously the comps have to support the exit price, and not with a lot of volatility. Consistently, the comps should be showing the borrower, hey, I can guarantee sell this for 120, 140, 180, whatever the number is, right? Another one really important to consider is if you couldn't sell it and you had to make it a rental, could you pay the insurance, the taxes, and the interest rate to the lender and still cash flow if you had to rent it, right? So that's what we call cash burn. What is your cash burn rate if you had to hold the property, right? So that should be positive. You don't want a property that's going to be in the red month to month until you sell it. And then arguably lastly is what I call marketability. How marketable is this product to the market as an investor, right? So for example, if it's going to sell for $250,000 and the rent's only $1,000, it's probably not going to cash flow for an investor. That's not very marketable. Is it in a D-class neighborhood with high crime? Not very marketable. Is it some odd shaped house, you know, 5 bedrooms, 1 bath, 1 bedroom, 1 bath condo, products that people usually don't want to buy? So the marketability is really important for the exit strategy. And if you consider all those four or five pieces, and they all look good, then you're probably in a good spot.
Yeah. And then once you look at your financials to make sure that 3 to 5,000 does still make the numbers work and you've passed those four tests, then you're way far and above what other investors are probably doing. I probably should have prefaced before we started talking about this, because a lot of people may not know what turnkey is. So these turnkey investment, turnkey again, is just, it's basically the investment's already ready to go. Somebody else has found the deal, they've rehabbed it, and they've gotten it rent ready. In most cases, they've already got a tenant in place. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So you only, your company only lends on these types of assets, right?
Yeah. Now we have one-off case where we have a third team in Ohio, friends of mine that do big flips, really great team as well, but those are one to two per year. So, but arguably most of them are turnkeys. Yes.
Very cool. All right. So the next part of the show, I just want to touch on your wealth blueprint. So sure. We're getting away from private lending here, as which is your bread and butter, but you also operate a website called reiacademy.co. Mm-hmm. And listeners can go to that website after the show to see what you're about and more about you. But I visited the site last night, and you talk a lot about the wealth blueprint. Mm. So the question I have for you is, why is having a blueprint important early on in one's investing career?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I grew up in finance, right? If you think about, you know, how businesses run their business, anyone who's worked in a company, what do you know? Well, you know that every 3 months the company meets to talk about where their actual results are versus plan and what that means for the overall year and what that means for the overall 3-year strategy in terms of revenue and profit. So, you know, I think many people, if they just switch their mindset slightly in that, look at yourself and your personal finance as a business, right? Create goals every quarter. But first, ask yourself, where do you want to be in 5 years, right? And simply do a backtrack process where you say, okay, great, in 5 years, this is where I need to be. Well, what does that mean year by year, backtracking? And then each year, what does that mean quarter by quarter? What do I have to achieve in terms of investing? What do I have to achieve in terms of my revenue growth or my income growth, right? And how best do I do that? And I think just that planning process alone, which essentially is the blueprint, you know, that's going to set you up to be able to measure your success and hold yourself accountable. Now, if you couple that with mentors, you know, a tax advisor, a legal advisor, you know, a financial advisor, not like a Fidelity, like my team, right? And you have that power team to hold you accountable, you're in a really good place to accomplish those goals. Or those KPIs, as you would call it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the blueprint is really a process to get you to that point for that roadmap. And that also is based on a number of other items. You know, what do you care about in life? Is it time? Is it travel? Is it freedom? Is it just money, right? Is it the idea of accomplishment? There's a lot of things that you could be chasing. And I think we could all agree the one thing that's going to help you get there is money.
Right. Yeah. I think now more than ever, anybody can create a course and tell you how to do something. But part of being truly successful is having those mastermind groups, having accountability.
That's right.
Napoleon Hill talks a lot about the mastermind group in his book. And I'm in a mastermind for real estate investors, about 250 of them. So however best you can, just have that accountability coupled with the how to do it. Because the accountability group will give you the purpose when things get hard. But a course or just having instructions is not always enough.
Yeah, well, I'd argue with it's almost never enough, right? Because someone, again, to your point, someone could give you the exact instructions, but it would have to match their exact use case. And every person has their own use case, their own personal situation. And it's different, right? Some people might be working a job as a teacher and unfortunately not getting paid very much and have a lot of school debt. So they're in a different situation versus someone who's a software engineer with no debt, right? So you can't just apply, to your point, the same rules of the game to every scenario.
Exactly. So another part of your content is the wealth accumulation flywheel. That's a concept I haven't really heard of. Explain that way. So can you go into how America is a consumption economy and how we're basically programmed to just buy, but your wealth accumulation flywheel basically flips that on its head?
Yeah.
And I'll let you go into that.
Yeah, sure. And there's actually a book up here. This book. And I know for everyone on the podcast, I'll mention the book, and then for the video, you'll see it. There's a guy out of Yale who I've interviewed. His name's Stephen Roach. And Stephen Roach was the chief investment officer for Morgan Stanley for about 30 years. The guy is no joke, right? So this is the book for you video viewers. It's called Unbalanced, right? Stephen Roach, you know, like unfortunately, like a cockroach without the first part. Anyways, so in the book, and kind of to my point, if you look at what the US economy has developed into since like 1950, right? Consumption has been a growing part of the economy, right? It's now like 74% of the overall economy. What that means is we're producing more of our GDP, which is the metric of, you know, an economy, production really. We're doing it more in the things that we buy. So like Walmart, Target, Amazon, that's the beneficiaries of that market. Whereas if you compare it to like a China, right, they're producing information, right? And that's the kind of economy that you want. But additionally, I say this because if we're consuming everything, that means we're not saving. That means we're not investing, right? So the first thing is, and I think this is a pretty obvious one, if you read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, or if you read any of the basic financial books, you know, saving roughly 20% of your income is the first step, right? And that can be from a W-2 job, that can be from a business, whatever it is. Try to save 20% of your income, okay, net income. And when you do that, and this is really the simple key to success, or not success, but, you know, wealth. And you put that money into assets that produce more money, right? And you just recycle that process over and over and over. And that's the flywheel, right? It will start very small. And again, as that flywheel slowly starts to move, the weight of it compounds. And at some point, there's a point of critical mass. I have seen around year 7 of the journey that it becomes substantial enough where you begin to have enough income coming in that tends to be about at or above your ability to spend it. Unless you go out and buy a Ferrari or Rolex watches or any of that. But if you're living the same lifestyle, saving the 20%, and you're doing this year over year and putting it into you know, income producing assets like private lending, like turnkey rentals, that is the secret to success, and money is to continue that. And eventually when you have so much, you just can't spend. I mean, it's hard to spend more than $15,000 a month. Like, and that's living a really good life, right? So if you're producing $40,000 a month, which is not that hard to achieve at some point, what do you do with all of it? Well, your mindset's already there. You're going to keep investing and you keep compounding wealth. And that is that flywheel.
Yeah. And the amazing part of it is that it just keeps repeating and compounding upon itself. Yeah. So it's, everyone talks about compound interest in terms of the stock market, but what you're saying is that passive income compound interest.
That's so right.
It's even more powerful in my opinion, because you don't have to wait until you're 60 or 65 on that.
Yeah. And here's the third, you know, an additional note to that is, look, I'm a believer in the stock market. I really am. And I think at a certain point you should be in it, but it doesn't produce income. It does produce wealth. And I'm now at a point where I have about a third of my wealth in the stock market, but I can do that because now I have a foundation of income coming in from my other assets. I wouldn't do the opposite, meaning I wouldn't start investing in stocks until you have the income producing portfolio built. And then you can decide, okay, hey, look, I have $5,000 extra a month. What do I do with it? All right. Then start buying, you know, whatever companies you want to buy or whatever. And then, you know, this is where you'll get a lot of pushback, but crypto would be far out. If I were to do it, it would be like, you know, play money that I'd be using. So,
yeah, just a nominal part of your net worth in that.
Yeah. Plus. I mean, just a quick tidbit, researchers from ARK Invest have found that the most amount of any crypto you should have in your portfolio is 7%. And that's based on a formula called the Sharpe ratio. And you can check it out. It's a ratio that measures risk versus return.
Okay. Yeah. I'll check that out.
Yeah.
The next kind of third of the show, I want to talk about remote investing, because you wrote a book called Beyond Your Backyard. It's a wonderful title, but I'm curious, what got you into remote investing? Was it because you were working in Silicon Valley at the time and had to? What was that story like?
Yeah, definitely. That was definitely the genesis of why, you know, and that's, I was almost an accidental landlord, as the typical story goes, but I had some intent. You know, I had my friend, Marco Santarelli, who owns Nerada Real Estate. Back then, he wasn't my friend. Back then, I didn't know him. I just heard his podcast. And then he sold turnkeys. I bought a few. It was great, right? But back then, you know, the digital world of property management really wasn't robust. There wasn't anything that really existed, right? So as I scaled up, I was like, man, it is kind of tough to manage afar. And the bloodline of your management is property managers. And I can't tell you the horror stories I've had with that. However, you know, about 3 years ago, I have a friend, her name's Dana. She runs a company called Hemlane. You know, she's a Harvard MBA, a hustler. They're well-funded. I was one of the first guinea pigs because I was like, I'm tired of this traditional property manager stuff. If there was a way to centralize all my management, I would do it. Well, I was a guinea pig. It was rough at first. Over some time, her engineers developed it into a product today that is absolutely incredible. And with platforms like Hemlane, which is spelled H-E-M-L-A-N-E, and there's other ones too. I think Mind has one, and there's a few digital property platforms that one are affordable. Two, they centralize all your operations, what you have to do to scale up your personal wealth. But they allow for remote investing, right? So today more than ever, it's become easier and easier to buy assets across the nation, and manage it from your laptop. I mean, literally I have done deals in places like the jungles of Bali, you know, and the beaches of Mexico. You can literally work in those places and use these platforms to be remote. I was living in Tokyo for a year and I was doing deals and managing, properties in the East Coast. So you're talking like a 12-hour time zone difference. And I was easily able to do it because of these digital platforms. And so when someone's like, oh, I live in California, I don't know if I should buy in Texas, you're talking 2 hours. That's easy peasy, right? So again, if you have the right tools in place, remote investing is an absolute no-brainer.
Really flips the whole traditional mindset on its head that you have to be 10 minutes away from your properties. You have to be able to touch them. But first, I want to discuss the systems you have in place. You mentioned systems. What are some of the systems that a beginning investor should have in place before they start investing remotely?
Interesting. Well, I mean, back to the blueprint, right? And kind of the planning process, as painful as it is, I do have a Google sheet that tracks. Well, again, so I have this thing called the three sheets mindset. And in business, there are three main sheets of any financial reporting package. That's the balance sheet, right? And the balance sheet, think of it as in your personal wealth, your personal net worth. So your assets minus any mortgages or loans that you have. So that's your net worth. You have your cash flow statement, right? So this will be a conglomeration of, you know, how you're spending your money, how you're investing your money, what's it being put in, what's the flow of the cash month to month. And then the last one is called a P&L or profit and loss statement. That would be your month to month budgeting, right? So you go in your bank statements once a month, set up a date, you do it on like a Saturday morning for an hour, and you input all the expenses. And you're tracking those as if you're a CFO of your own company or of your own personal wealth. And so that's number one. You got to have a reporting package to understand where your money is going, how you're using it, right? And then you can begin to reduce and, you know, maximize from there. Once you have that, then depending on your asset class, my buddy Bobby Sharma owns a company called bettercapital.us. That's a platform that you can manage private money loans, assets, and track it from there. There's another one called Stessa, or assets spelled backwards. Another great one to manage all your personal wealth. Then, of course, from a property management side, again, I use Hemlane. I think they're fantastic. So between those three tools, in your own package of reporting, that's going to set you up very nicely to manage your operations. Now, eventually, and a lot of my clients have now got to a point with wealth where they need more than that. Eventually, you'll hire a bookkeeper to do your QuickBooks once a month. It's $40 once a month to clean up all your books. You'll probably end up hiring an admin assistant to do a lot of the monotony of the day-to-day, right? And then as you grow, you're naturally going to hire more people in your team, and that's kind of the process of scaling. But it does start with a basic package of understanding where your financials are, how you're using your money, and then ultimately using these digital platforms to scale up your entire operation.
Right. Yeah. Knowing your financials is so important. I'm
yeah
a CPA myself, so I'm big on
there you go
financials. Do you recommend investing remotely to start one's real estate career? Because personally, I'm in a lower cost Midwest market. Sure. And I don't feel the need to invest remotely, although you may disagree because you need to be diversified between markets.
Yeah.
But do you recommend that?
Let me ask you this. Let's say you had a house next door. Nice. You can see the house. The toilet leaks at 2 a.m. One, do you know how to fix it? Probably not. Most people don't know how to fix anything these days, which is okay. Two, do you want to deal with a broken toilet?
No.
So you're going to call a plumber to do it anyways. You know, the only benefit of it being close is if you really wanted to go over and see what the plumber was doing, you could watch over their shoulder for an hour or 2 hours, right? You're probably not going to do that anyways. So especially if you're 30 minutes away. So it's going to be the same process if you're 30 minutes away as if you're 2 hours away or if you're a plane ride away. My point is, I get that there's some sort of satisfaction and it just feels better to have a house close to you. And there is some benefit, you know, you can drive by and see if the grass is cut. You can see the condition of the house, but you can also hire someone once every 6 months to do a walkthrough of the house, to do an inspection. That's what I do. And there's enough things in place to make sure that you're not going down the wrong path. So again, long story short, is there a benefit of investing close to you? There's some. Is it enough to not invest remotely? Absolutely not. I don't think there's anything wrong with starting remotely as your first investments. Again, learn the market, know your team, know what you're buying, think about those variables that I mentioned earlier, and you should be fine.
Perfect. That makes a lot of sense. So to wrap this up, I want to, again, talk about you a little bit. What has been your biggest failure this year and why do you think that happened?
Biggest failure this year in the last 6 months. I haven't had any sort of like catastrophic losses, or any of that. I think, and I'll just be transparent here, what I struggle with, and not often, but I have learned in real estate that if your intuition is telling you not to do it, don't do it. And I don't know what it is. I don't know if that's across the board or for everyone. And it's not really like a metric based thing. It's just if the feeling's off in real estate, when I've gone through and done whatever I wasn't feeling right about doing, it has resulted in a lackluster result. And this year was another one where just recently as a land deal, I didn't feel good about it. We went through, put it in contract. You know, I had spent like $4,000 for the, what they call option period, which is non-refundable. Didn't feel good about it. It ended up being the wrong choice. Lost $4,000 in about 10 days. You know, not the biggest amount of money, but it was the thought process behind it. And then secondly, I was actually in the midst of opening barbershops. Long story there, but essentially it's like a real estate model. And that was a situation where I did all my due diligence. Numbers looked fantastic. I was about to sign the lease. And then I started trying to recruit barbers and I realized that there were no barbers to recruit. I was like, man, I would have spent $100,000 on this build out. And I would have had no revenue and been eating my shorts for 3 years on this business. So that was an almost failure. And then the land was probably the actual failure of the year so far. But typically I'm you know, as a CPA, I'm sure you can appreciate this. I'm maniacal about numbers and I obsess over trying to find not the yes in deals, but the no. Why do I not want to do this? So I obsess over that angle. So fortunately it's been great. I have not made many mistakes in my career. Beyond these intuition ones.
Would you agree that as you get farther along, you're more defined by what you say no to versus what you say yes? Because I've heard that you just have so many opportunities as your network grows and as people know more about you that you could almost say yes to everything and really lose in a lot of cases.
You know, I think people, I have learned, and I've always been high integrity, transparency in all my negotiations and deals. And I find that people really gravitate towards that, right? If you are an open book, if you have, you know, integrity in all your dealings, people care about that. And if you care about your clients, they care about that too. That's probably number one. Number two, I would actually say people do judge you by your successes more than your, what you say no to. So if I can give a smashing success in a land deal, my clients are going to be judging me on that. Like, wow, this guy executed flawlessly. We made phenomenal returns. They'll appreciate that I say no to certain deals. And I think they'll see you as a prudent investor who does the work and does the research, but I think they'll remember the big home runs that you bring them.
Yeah. Yeah. Another question. What has been the app, tool, or resource that has been the biggest game changer for your business? I know you mentioned a few tools that help you invest remotely. What would that single resource be?
Geez, I mean, you know, there's nothing technology-wise that has really been earth-shattering. Google Sheets is definitely one of them. But I think of tools beyond just tech. And at some point, for everyone out there listening, a tax strategist that actually gets it, understands how to, you know, maneuver in the current environment through asset classes, how to actually produce tax shields. That may be one of the most important pieces to the puzzle. So to me, that's a tool. I meet with my accountant every 3 months. Again, and I have goals, right? And we have a goal to shield as much taxes as I can. And if I'm not tracking, he holds me accountable, right? So to your earlier comment, I have someone that holds me accountable for those transactions. And so that's probably the most effective tool I have. And then, yeah, probably just Google Sheets.
Yeah. As an accountant myself, I mean, you're spot on. Your tax strategist, your legal counsel can be some of the most important team members in your whole career. But you got to make sure you find one who's willing to sit down with you every 3 months, who knows real estate and even some stock strategies. So,
right.
There is an app that it escapes me, but there's an app that recently came out where for a remote investor, you can have your contractors like take pictures of the progress and then it sends it to you.
Oh, interesting.
I want to put that in the show notes after I get off the show. I'll find out the exact name on it because that's pretty revolutionary. I mean, if you're doing flips or rehabs from afar, it's almost a must.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just have to trust your contractors, which we know how blind trust goes sometimes, or just, you know, it just puts a system in place there.
Yeah. Agreed.
Where can folks buy your books? And you have a couple courses.
Yeah.
And you also have your Wealth Blueprint program.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So reiacademy.co, that's got everything there. So that's not a bad spot to start. You can email me directly, which is tom@betterturnkey.com. And then, you know, what I first do is with any client or anything, I like to understand where they're at in their current journey and then understand how best to help them, if at all. I mean, in terms of the instant access to content, reiacademy.co is your best spot.
Awesome. And where can listeners get a hold of you other than tom@betterturnkey.com?
Well, if not email, I'll give my phone number. 717.
Oh, you don't have to.
Just email me. We'll get a meeting going and, go from there and get started.
Very good. Well, any other last points you want to make before we call it an episode?
Yeah, I just want, it's awesome that you're doing this podcast. And for any of you listening out there, it's, if you're listening, your mind's in the right place. I think, you're obviously curious and, having the money and the power of investing successfully and growing your wealth produces so much opportunity. And from my experience, they say, money can't buy happiness, but I don't know, man, I've had a lot of happiness from money, whether it be fast cars or travel or treating my family to whatever. So I think it can do a lot of things. So anyone out there listening, good for you for listening.
Yeah. I think money is so crucial to our lives. And it's just something that, everybody is going to place a certain amount of value on it. If you're working a job, you're going to spend the majority of your waking hours to earn it.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, it's one of the most important things to focus on because we're both passionate about the freedom found with wealth, not necessarily the things it can buy. So one of the questions I wanted to add in your opinion, what is the quickest way somebody can achieve financial freedom? Like we talked about how maybe putting all your eggs in one basket is not the right move, but what's the quickest way?
Unfortunately, there's just no quick way. No, I know that's not what people want to hear, but you know, I think there's nothing wrong with keeping a job and working up your little nest egg on the side. And eventually once that side nest egg gets close to replacing your W-2 income, that's when you make a move, right? I mean, ultimately the fastest way to wealth is by owning companies. And that is a ton of stress and a ton of work. But that is by far the most lucrative way of life. Mm-hmm. And then I would say secondly is this investor model where you're the flywheel, right? Do the flywheel. And over time, it takes time, 5 to 7 years, and you'll really see a compound. But that's, unfortunately, 5 to 7 years is the fastest I've seen anyone, unless you're working for like a tech company and you get lucky to go IPO, but I wouldn't count on luck.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a great way to end it. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and knowledge, Tom. And
got it.
Again, go to reiacademy.co to learn more about him. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Real Estate Investing for Freedom podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a review. And tune in next week for the next episode.